Okay, so, oh, now I can add him to call. Let's see how this works. It's ringing.
All right.
It's actually a little early.
This is David.
David.
Hey.
I'm a little early, it turns out.
Yeah, that's fine.
That's awesome. I have Paul and Scott all on the line with us all at the same time.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, guys.
Hi, David.
Thanks for having me.
No,
hey,
it's
thanks
awesome.
For being on.
So before we get started, I need help in pronouncing your last name.
Oh, yeah, I know. I should have sent that to you. It's basically, it's completely phonetic, so if you can read and sound it out, you can say it.
Mizuski?
Mizajewski.
Mizajewski. Mizajewski. So there's a little, oh, I can't say that, see?
Mizajewski?
Mizajewski.
You got it, that's perfect.
Mizajewski.
That was a small type of candy in the 60s, wasn't it? You could get it.
I remember, I didn't like the little black
Mom,
ones.
Mom, where are the Mizajewskis?
The little black Mizajewskis are kind of gross. I like the colored ones, the rainbow colored ones.
That was before my time, so I wouldn't know.
Right, exactly.
Oh, God, that hurt. Lower back.
All right, so we're recording as usual. And today, so I need to do the little thing. Today is the 3rd of March, and that was Paul's chair.
That's my chair. I must oil this one of these days.
Yes, you really do need to. And I have, what is this? What episode are we on? Is this like 47?
Good Lord. I don't. Yeah,
David, do you know?
I don't. I listen to the show, but I don't keep track of the
47.
Episode number.
It's episode 47 on the 3rd of March in the year of our Lord 2013. And we have on the show today, we have Scott Harriet. Say hello,
hello,
Scott. We have Paul Vella.
Hello.
And David Mizes. See, I knew I was going to do that.
I'll spare you the pain of pronouncing it. Mizajewski.
Mizajewski, who's a we're thrilled to have him on. I'll do the little intro for David, and then we'll just get into the show. So David is a naturalist. He's a blogger, author, and media personality with the National Wildlife Federation. He's a lifelong nature geek and a student of the natural world. He spent his youth exploring the suburban woods and fields and earned a degree in human and natural ecology from Emory University. As a naturalist, David interprets the science behind the natural world to educate the public and to inspire people to join the cause of conservation. David does numerous television appearances and podcast appearances with wildlife to promote conservation and is a regular guest on such shows as The Today Show,
wow,
Conan,
whoa,
Martha Stewart Show, The Wendy Williams Show, Good Morning America, and Good Morning America. David also regularly appears on networks such as Nat Geo Wild, CNN, HGTV, Sundance Channel, and Animal Planet. David hosted the Animal Planet series Backyard Habitat, which I remember seeing, which shows viewers how to restore wildlife habitat in urban and suburban areas. He currently writes the blog Animal Oddities for Animal Planet. That is the most professional sounding introduction we have ever done on a Bigfoot show.
And that's our show. Good night.
Good night, everybody. It's all going to be downhill from there. So, David, thanks for being on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really excited.
My first question for you is, can you explain to everybody, because I know I posted on our Facebook page that you were going to be on. And
yep.
One of the things that seemed, and I think that I share this with our listeners, can you explain the difference between a naturalist and, say, a biologist or any other kind of ist that you want to compare it to?
Sure, yeah. No, that's a great place to start because, you know, I think it's important that people kind of get the distinction. You don't necessarily go to school and get a degree in being a naturalist. You know, a naturalist is somebody that, you know, generally speaking, has a, you know, sort of a broad knowledge of the natural world. And but the key thing is that a naturalist is first and foremost a communicator. So, you know, my job is not just to know about the natural world and about wildlife and, you know, all sorts of ecological processes. It's the ability to talk about it in a way that the general public, you know, can kind of grasp. And typically naturalists, you know, our ultimate goal is to, like you read in my bio there, is to sort of inspire people to get involved in the protection of the natural world. So, you know, Charles Darwin was a naturalist. David Attenborough is a naturalist. You know, there are many, I mean, Jane Goodall could be considered a naturalist. So it's not something that you go and get one degree in the way that you would, you know, if you were going to take, become a biologist or a zoologist or, you know, any other ologist kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. So again, I sort of have a broad-based knowledge and, you know, I like I said, I consider my job to be communicating and inspiring people to get involved in protecting wildlife on the planet.
Awesome. How did you listen to the show? I didn't.
Yep.
We connected via the social networks, and but you previously listened. What drives your interest in this subject?
So yeah, I'm a huge fan of the show. I just want to say that too. You know, I think you guys strike the perfect balance of, you know, kind of exploring this whole mysterious phenomenon in a way that, you know, is as scientific as it can be, and also you guys keep in mind the, you know, maybe just some of the, I think the right balance of humor when you talk about the subject and a lot of the antics that go on in it. So my personal interest in the subject, you know, probably like you guys and many of the listeners, goes back to, you know, being a little kid and, you know, catching, you know, TV shows, specials and whatnot. You know, this was before cable, so, you know, public TV or whatever, wherever they were. You know, this idea of this sort of hairy, you know, ape-like creature that roams North America, you know, as a small kid really piqued my curiosity. It also mm-hmm. piqued my fear. You know, I spent a lot of time running around in the woods as a kid, and it was just sort of this sort of really fascinating notion that something like that could exist. Sure. But it's not just that interests me. You know, I think, you know, again, so sort of as a naturalist, I'm interested in the prospect that maybe this thing exists. You know, this undiscovered animal species that's out there that no one has been able to really definitively prove. But I'm also, you know, really big into, you know, sci-fi and fantasy, and I'm a geek as far as that goes too. And so whether or not these things even exist, just the idea that, you know, the sort of from the monster angle, love hearing stories and listening to podcasts and yes, watching Finding Bigfoot, from that angle too. So just sort of from that pure, you know, kind of monster, kind of aspect. And then the third thing that kind of draws me to being interested in the topic, this is the one I want to say a little bit delicately, but I think you guys will appreciate this, is that, you know, there's a lot of interesting characters and interesting activities and, you know, all the hoopla that goes along with the subject of Bigfoot. And I have to say that from, you know, maybe an anthropological point of view, I find it fascinating to sort of watch all of that play out kind of from the sidelines. You know, I'm not a Bigfoot researcher. I don't go out into the woods Bigfooting. I'm interested in the subject. I kind of watch it from the sidelines. And, you know, I'd love it if these things existed and we figured out a way to demonstrate that to the scientific world. But as I've said, you know, I'm a skeptic, and I probably would say I'm an agnostic. You know, mm-hmm. when evidence is presented that is credible and the scientific community, you know, sort of has a consensus on that, or maybe if I had a personal sighting, mm-hmm. that would bump me into maybe not being an agnostic. I think that there's some compelling evidence that can't be explained away that I think does warrant people going out there and trying to find the answer. But until that happens, I can't say that something like this exists.
Mm. So I was going to say, you're definitely, and man, you are a good, clear, fast talker. I just want to say that I actually went and got a sandwich.
Shows the facility. It's but I was 28 listening the whole long, right?
Yeah, no, it's great. There's a lot of info in there. It was awesome. I think David represents a good, a healthy skepticism, but it's clear he's not a skeptic. He's not some, oh, well, you know, all these sightings can be explained with, you know, genetic memory and whatnot. So you're clearly open-minded to it. And, I mean, even for believers like Brian and myself and Sam and God knows what Paul is, I respect it. He's an agnostic as well. Would that be fair to say, Paul, an agnostic on the big...
Yeah, I think so.
Is and now I lost my train of thought.
I think what you were saying, and I think it's accurate that, you know, I'm not, you know, just because I don't necessarily believe that these creatures exist from a scientific point of view does not mean that I'm going to say out of hand the whole thing is a ridiculous farce. You know, I do think that probably a lot of things like sightings. And this is based on my personal and professional experience. I do think that probably the majority of those are things like misidentifications or you know, sort of trick of the eye kinds of things. And you know, for example, you know, I've worked at nature centers, you know, over the years, and also with my work at National Wildlife Federation, kind of being a public face, you know, we get phone calls and emails all the time of people saying, "Oh my God, I saw this in my yard," or "Here's a picture of this, and this is what it is." And I got to say, and this is no slight to anyone out there, but the American public is just really horrible at identifying wildlife.
No.
It's just a fact of, you know, it's just a reality. And I would say probably 80% of the time, well-meaning people who think they saw what they saw and they are convinced of it are wrong. You know, if you know a little bit about wildlife and how to identify them and, you know, things like where certain animals should be and where they shouldn't be and whatever. You know, so again, it's part of my job to help educate people about that when maybe they do have a misidentification or something sure. like that. You know, a lot of times it's a bobcat and, there was a mountain lion in my yard, that kind of thing. So when I hear, you know, Bigfoot related stories and sightings, I have to put it through that filter first. And just know that probably a big percentage of those are those kinds of misidentifications. Now, with that said, I think there are some really compelling, you know, anecdotal tales that I've heard, you know, a lot of which you guys discuss on the show that, you know, maybe not. You know, some of these people are credible witnesses that do know what they're talking about. And I have no explanation for what those people are seeing until, again, I see it for myself or until probably we have a body that the scientific world can investigate and definitively say that this thing exists.
Wait a minute. A body? Are you a bloodthirsty killer?
No, he did not say that. Well, let's not open that garbage can.
Go ahead, Paul. You probably want to say something.
I was going to say, it's the point that David raised, it's fair to say that unless you are spending a lot of time with animals, animal identification is tough. And I think back to a few years back where I nearly trodden a snake in my backyard. Now, you spend most of your time in the United States, but we only have two or three breeds of snake in Britain. So the snakes that we have are easily identifiable. And the one that I saw was not one of those, absolutely mm-hmm. wasn't one of those, which means it must have been an exotic pet or something. But after I'd spoken to a couple of people about it, and this is, you know, I'm talking of somebody that chastises people all the time for not remembering much about their sightings of Bigfoot and Nessies and all sorts of things. I couldn't remember what the bloody snake looked like. I was thinking, I could have sworn it had a sort of V-shaped marking, and then I couldn't decide whether it was striped or was it black or was it dark brown. And by the time I'd spoken to a couple of snake experts about it, I just had to hold my hands up and say, do you know what? I've got no idea what it looked like. It was a snake.
Paul, were you at the zoo at the time?
No. It was in my back garden.
Okay. That's right.
But people are really bad at identifying animals. We have a, not far from where I live, we have a small colony of wallabies that are escapees from a private zoo. You talk to the police officers in the area, they have never yet had a motorist come in and say, I've just run over a wallaby. It's always, I've just hit a kangaroo.
Right.
Well, yeah. Every time, without fail.
Yeah, well, they're like little. They're just little kangaroos, right? That's all a wallaby is.
Yeah.
We should know the difference.
Yeah. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it's for good or for ill, most people are not particularly knowledgeable about not only identifying wild animals in a generic sense, you know, just sort of here's an animal that lives on this planet and this is what it is, but even worse, in my opinion, is that they don't even know the animals that live around them anymore. You know, and this is a big part of the work that National Wildlife Federation does is actually to try to get people reconnected to nature, particularly kids. But, you know, to sort of combat that because, yeah, I mean, it is an issue, and I think it does play a big role in the whole, you know, Sasquatch, Bigfoot phenomenon. I think that a lot of what people are seeing and they genuinely believe what they think that they have seen are probably not that.
I think that knowing, that we've said it on the show before, but knowing the critters in your woods is really important if you actually sort of style yourself as some sort of, you know, researcher in the field. Because, I mean, I kind of have a pretty good idea what's in Minnesota woods, but like when I go down to Oklahoma or Texas, I have no experience with things like armadillos, for example. And armadillos, mm-hmm. when they're moving through the underbrush, they sound like an elephant, right? I mean, they sound big. And, you know, if you don't know what an armadillo sounds like and you went down there and there wasn't somebody who did sit next to you saying, oh, it's just an armadillo, chill out. You know, I mean, that's kind of right. important to know the critters in your woods.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the other thing that goes along with that, too, is that even if people get the species right, people are notoriously awful about judging size and distance
totally.
and, and weight and things like that. And again, I don't need to tell you guys this, but it's the whole fishing story idea where, you know, I typically, when somebody tells me that they saw an animal at X size, I will automatically, in my mind, reduce it by, you know, 2 feet or, you know, 100 pounds or whatever, you know, because, again, most people don't have any concept of the real size and mass and weight of animals. So again, as a professional naturalist, you know, when I hear folks talk about their Bigfoot sightings, I have to run it through that filter of my experience and my what I know to be true about how people relate to and observe wildlife, especially lay people.
Hey, David, can you, as a naturalist, explain to a lay person the basic, although we've talked about it on the show with other guests and amongst ourselves, but the essentially the basic peer review process, especially when it comes to DNA, so that maybe anybody who is listening and is believing against all odds that you know, Melba Ketchum actually has something. And again, I'm not saying she doesn't, but it's the way in which it was presented.
We're going to come back to that too. I'd like to hear what he says.
And before you do that, David, when you do get around to doing that, we'd like to know about the real peer review process, not the new inventive one that we seem to have.
Will you make up your own journal? Yeah, I mean, what I'll have to say on this is brief, because again, I'm not a biologist. I've never been published. You know, I don't do scientific research myself. My job is to work with scientists and other folks that do that and figure out what is the messaging that is coming out of that research that you're doing that we can communicate to the public. In my case, you know, because I work for a conservation organization that will help people get more involved in, again, the conservation based on that science. So I think you guys have done a really great job on the show of kind of pointing out what the real process is and what, you know, what you really should not do, as well as on the Facebook page. And I've been following the whole Melba Ketchum debacle via you guys mostly and the web. And I think that there's nothing that I can say that has not already been said more articulately by some of the other folks that you've asked this question to. But in essence, you know, you go out there and you create a hypothesis and you test it. And then you seek to get that, you know, whatever results you find one way or the other, you know, publish in a peer review journal where other scientists look at it and try to shoot holes in that, and then ultimately end up trying to replicate what you have done. And once that happens, then your theory or your hypothesis might be accepted as a theory, and it might be something that then gains general acceptance. But there is a protocol for how you do these things to make sure that that everyone is impartial, that you're dotting all your I's and crossing all your T's. And yes, there is a sort of a human personality dynamic where, yes, if you do it the wrong way, you're going to be ridiculed and, you know, people are going to automatically be skeptical. You know, the scientific world is competitive and you know, the scientists are out there competing for research dollars and notoriety and all those other things. So, yes, like you have to go into the process of peer review and putting your research out there with some thick skin, and you have to be prepared for the community at large to punch holes in it. And if you're not, then you kind of have no business being in the quote unquote field of science in the first place.
So David, is that what you're saying, if I hear you correctly, is that I just can't put anything on the internet and then expect everyone to think it's true. I mean, that's the scientific process now. Now, I would say that the scientific process was invented before the internet. So are you sure that I just can't put anything on the internet and then expect everyone to believe it?
I'm pretty sure that that is a true statement.
All right.
Which is not to say that if you put something on the internet, lots of people won't believe it. And I think that's what we're seeing happening.
We got to watch a little exchange between some of those on our Facebook page the other day.
Oh, it was fun, wasn't it?
So also, I have a question for you. In your professional opinion, the likelihood of a 500-pound lemur getting it on with a woman is, and then not only just getting it on, because, you know, all kinds of things happen in Tijuana. What I'm saying is they get it on and then produce viable offspring. The odds of that happening, in your opinion, would be roughly
like negative numbers, you know. I mean, I just, you know, I mean, lemurs are, you know, a kind of primate. They're a prosimian, which is sort of the, again, the quote-unquote primitive group of primates, you know, sort of monkeys, apes, you know, humans, which arguably are apes. And then you have the prosimian, so the lemurs, the eyes, things like that. And they're found, the lemurs evolved from mainland prosimians when Madagascar kind of split off as India moved away from mainland Africa, and sort of this island, which is now a country called Madagascar, is where these animals were isolated and evolved from the generic kind of prosimians, like bush babies and things like that, into this multitude of different lemur species, you know, ringtail lemurs and shavakas, mm-hmm. and black and white rough lemurs, and you know, all the other species. I think there's 50 of them or something like that.
And they're so, found nowhere else, right? They're only on Madagascar.
Correct.
Or the exactly. islands around Madagascar.
Right. So I don't know how some ancient giant lemur would have, you know, found, you know, a primitive human being, modern human being, in wherever it's being said that this maybe happened, which I haven't read through all that. Again, I just saw your post that you pushed out on the Bigfoot Show Facebook page, but, you know, I glanced at it and rolled my eyes because I just don't know how that could possibly ever happen and result in animals here in North America that have that genetic lineage. It just doesn't seem to make any sense. Not to mention that in order to interbreed, you have to be really close. You know, I mean, you know, lions and tigers can interbreed, but you know, horses and mules, so, or donkeys.
David, you know, what we're overlooking here is the fact that, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't there at least one type of lemur that we know of now that actually has bioluminescence in its eyes? And we know that various Sasquatch reports report an apparent bioluminescence. So, you know, come on. Science.
Science. That's just the science right there.
Actually, I don't know about that. Is there really a lemur that
they're actually I remember reading that several years ago that it was there is a form, I don't know how intense it is, but at least a type of lemur that is, its eyes are bioluminescent.
The point is, you've said it now. This show is on the internet, so that's good enough. That's true.
Yeah.
So there is a species of lemur with bioluminescent eyes because you said it on the internet.
No, I read it. Now we have to research it, and if we find it,
No. See, you're muddling this up with a bunch of nonsense. You said it. It sounds cool. Let's just say it's true. And so therefore, we back up Melba's assertion with this piece of thing you just pulled out of your ear.
I did, no, but I mean, I'm just hopeful that there is no. I don't think we have a lot of Melba diehards listening to the show, because I don't think they would understand 25% of the words we use. But I don't know. It's just it's you know, I don't know. The thing with, we said this about Melba, and it's easy to go into one camp or another about her, that she's a fraud, or she's cuckoo, or she's a numbskull. You know, I think it's a little bit of everything. I don't think she's a total Biscardi, cold-hearted con man, if in fact he is one, which I think he is. I think it's a little bit of everything. It's just whatever it is, it's just all points in a very non-scientific direction. So again, I just want to reiterate that she may have, I mean, some of those samples she has, I'm not saying that she doesn't have that, but the way it was analyzed, presented, et cetera, how the heck are we going to know? It's not that we're not, you know, it's not this Galileo effect that she's claiming, you know, this paranoid type of attitude. It's just, no, man, it's not here. The data isn't here that says it beyond any reasonable doubt. So,
yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think, you know, this is one of the things that I think folks that are interested in the subject, especially people that are really involved and are part of this community, need to just, you know, you need to accept a hard, cold truth. And that is, you know, every time Melba Ketchum might have some really great data, but the way that she went about, you know, moving forward and quote unquote publishing it, and I'm using a lot of air quotes here, but, you know, unfortunately, it did nothing but discredit the whole concept of the possibility of these animals existing by the you know, the regular scientific world out there.
Right.
Every time something like that happens, you know, it is a unfortunate reality that it pushes the likelihood of, you know, again, barring somebody on a slab somewhere, the likelihood that anybody is going to take this serious beyond the existing community. And that's just the reality of it. And people can be get upset about that and talk about government conspiracies and everything else.
Yeah. Right.
You know, frankly, that's all hogwash. You know, it's like, show me the scientific evidence that will be accepted by, again, the standard scientific process and community, and then I will believe 100%. Until you do that, then there, you know, I can't say that these things exist, you know, and that's just how it goes.
But for example, I mean, it sounds like, based on what you've said, that if Sykes comes out with a report, whatever that's going to be, and if some of the samples that he got, one of which from Oklahoma, and it's like, you know what? This says unknown primate. The chain of evidence is secure in that it came from the U.S. Would that raise your probability a bit toward believing?
Yeah, absolutely, it would. And for someone like me, again, that does not do the science myself, what would really sort of push me into an area of interest as far as something like that would go is if the reports from the actual scientific community were coming out saying, this is interesting. This is something that is unknown. You know, we can't say what it is one way or the other, but this was done, to your point, Scott, you know, with the right chain of custody, and we know that we can rule out, you know, contamination, and we can rule out other species or whatever. Right. You know, that's the kind of thing where I would then start to pick up and really, from a, again, kind of that scientific professional point of view, some notice. And then I would wait until many more examples of that came out, and again, maybe right. body or whatever. And so, you don't just get one piece of data or one study and then be able to definitively say anything. I mean, science is, people think science is black and white, but it often isn't. It's sort of this evolving process based on what data you have available to you and how scientists are interpreting and studying that data. And you have to tweak things as you go. And so it's not like, you don't necessarily get a smoking gun. You know, you have to have a body of evidence and a body of research and data before you can start making some real conclusions sometimes. And you know, again, unfortunately, we just don't have that in this instance.
Just a quick thing, Brian. I just wanted to say to David's point about, you know, what we've got is a possible scenario here that it could be like, you know, the woman who cried Bigfoot. Because let's say Mel Burkett, you know, just not well presented, right? But you have these believers, and let's say a genuine believer brings in a hair that actually is from an actual Sasquatch. Well, now you've got less people based on Melba's history willing right. to even look at it, as opposed yep. to someone like Sykes, whose reputation is pretty solid. I mean, you don't end up being an Oxford professor and regarded as one of the best, you know, geneticists and stuff in the natural world for nothing. It just, they don't, you know, pick it out of a hat. So even though that doesn't speak directly to the strength of the evidence, as far as it being listened to, I mean, it's going to be mm-hmm. tons more, you know, difficult now for Ketchum to be taken seriously because of the sloppy way in which the evidence was presented.
She's finished.
Yeah, and not only Ketchum, anyone else that comes right. forward and says that they have Bigfoot DNA. So, right. yeah, I mean, that is my point. It is an unfortunate reality, but every time something like this happens and every time a hoax comes out, it sets the whole, you know, the whole hope that there is going to be credible evidence that comes out about this phenomenon that it just sets the whole thing back, and it makes it the bar much higher each time something like this happens yep. for people that might have legitimate stuff going on to get over it. And again, that's where I go back to the whole body thing, which I know you guys
yeah.
have debated about.
Yeah,
in the past,
come on,
but
bring
like,
it up. I
don't know. I mean, at this stage of the game, again, with all of the hoaxes and all of the mishandling of potentially good data, but we'll never know at this point, i.e. Melba Ketchum, I just don't see anybody really, again, in the mainstream world, the mainstream science world, buying that something like this exists without hard physical evidence yeah. in the form of a body or a big piece of a body that cannot be, you know, misconstrued or misidentified, you know. And yes, DNA could do that, but I don't, you know, it's just like video, photo, anecdotes, and all that kind of visual anecdotes. All of that is interesting, but I just don't think it's what the bigger outside scientific community is ever going to based on that alone, make a definitive statement that, that these creatures exist.
Well,
I think you need a body.
That if you go back and to your point, and we'll get to the body thing in a minute because definitely we're going to go there. But if you go back and look at, you know, when people were finding footprints and they were casting them, and there was a lot of interest in that, like legitimate interest in those things, and then what followed on, and perhaps some of them, you know, I'm not saying that they were all legitimate, but perhaps some of them were, what followed on was a lot of crappy fakes and a bunch of, you know, just junk. And so eventually what happens is entire fields of evidence become tainted. Photographs become tainted because of people like Marx, you know, and I think, even though it should be pretty hard and almost indisputable from a scientific standpoint, it happens in, with DNA now. And this was my point from the last show, that Ketchum has made it such a joke that respectable people, and I know that there are those out there who will still take a sample, but it becomes harder, I think, for respectable people to even entertain the possibility because of people like Ketchum. And I think that's your point, David. I don't want to say that.
You said it more articulately than I did, but that's totally my point. And you know, and I'll say I feel like I should probably give a disclaimer that, you know, I'm here on this show talking from my, you know, a personal point of view and not necessarily as a representative of National Wildlife Federation, because we're a science-based conservation organization.
Sure.
And you know, we don't recognize the existence of an animal like this, and nor should we, until the evidence is there. And so because of that the stigma, because of all the crazies and the people that bungle things, potential scientific evidence, nobody legit wants to touch this stuff, you know?
Right.
Again, I have an interest in it from those three different perspectives, only one of which is sort of a scientific one. And so that's why I listen to your show and I kind of follow from the sidelines just to see what goes on. And it would make me extremely happy as a naturalist if something like this actually existed.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I'm an agnostic until I see that evidence. And National Wildlife Federation, again, does not recognize the existence of these guys. And,
right.
And so, you know, again, just to put that disclaimer out there in case, you know, I mean, what you were saying, you know, legitimate science and conservationists, you know, could get up in arms about me talking about Bigfoot or whatever. And so I feel like I need to do that because of the stigma resulting from a lot of what we've just been talking
about
people bungling and, you know.
So, David, you're out in the woods. You're a naturalist. You have a high-powered rifle. You see a Sasquatch. Would you try to kill one, put it right between its eyes?
Well, you know, that's actually a really interesting way of phrasing that question, because in a generic sense, not necessarily me, I would say yes. I'm not a hunter, and I don't know that I can pull that trigger, but especially in the heat of that moment. But I do think that, you know, if you want to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that these are actual living, breathing beings on this planet, that is what you're going to have to do. Or you know, again, you know, maybe one gets hit by a car and you get a piece of a body
or
that
remains,
way, or you stumble
remains,
on a yeah, exactly. But yeah, and for good or for ill, I think that is the reality. You know, I'm not a hunter, like I said. I'm not a big gun. I don't have a gun. I've shot a gun once at a shooting range with some friends, you know, so I don't know that I could be the person to do that. But if
right.
somebody did it, you know, and I also will say, I'm an animal lover, you know, I'm liberal, you know, I don't believe in just, you know, personally going out and blasting up wildlife. That's not what this is about. But if somebody went out and was able to shoot one of these things, if they are indeed real, to bring it in to prove to the world that these things exist, and then potentially then, depending on how many there are and whatever else comes out of that discovery in terms of learning about them and their populations and whether or not we need to conserve that and protect their habitat and everything. I mean, I think that's what would need to happen. You know, I just don't see it happening any other way. And, you know, a few shows back.
I do. Wait,
I think a few shows back you guys were debating this and Scott, you know, you were saying to Brian that, you know, the easiest way is to shoot one. And I think you were confusing with the word, you know, the easiest with most effective. You know, if you want to prove that
that's what I meant, the most effective way.
And so I have to agree with that. Would I be the one that wanted to pull the trigger? Probably not, you know, but if somebody did it, in the right, you know, and then brought it forward in the right way, legitimately, to and the scientific world saw that and had that body to study so that we could prove that they existed, I would have no problem with that whatsoever. Because, again, for good or for ill, that is how science works.
So,
and yes, you can go out and get a DNA sample with a dart and all that stuff, but that's not going to be as effective as a body. Or
so,
a piece of a body.
A lot of things, and I have so many things I want to talk to you about this, but one of the things that people point to was this Highland manga bay that was listed via only photographs and DNA, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of people use that as an example, say, look, we can do this without having
Brian, what is that? A Highland what? What is it?
Highland manga bay. It's a little monkey kind of thing. I don't know exactly what it is. It's but because I'm not. You know, I have a radio show on the internet, so whatever I say is true. But there was still a type specimen taken of that animal. I mean, the point I want to make, regardless of individual philosophical beliefs about this, is this is the way science works. Even if they will list your animal using something other than the holotype, the type specimen, eventually they're going to collect a type specimen.
Because, yeah, but it doesn't mean you have to go out and kill one. You could get a tracking device on one, let it live its life, and then when it dies naturally, you could retrieve the body. It's still, I agree, it would be the most expeditious way. But again, obviously I have a moral issue with this. And because I don't buy the argument either, because something's been done a certain way before, that justifies it now, especially with our increased technology. And again, like we argued on the other show, that it's a question of patience. It's like, well, we have to find it now. Well, I don't think we have to find it now. Making the argument that it's a sense of urgency doesn't really sway me. Like, we're going to be saving so many more if we kill one now, because we don't even know how many there are, if in fact they do exist.
So before,
right, I think that, I think that's
ahead.
A really important point, though, is that it's hard. I guess, you know, I don't know. I mean, if
can't we just get one to come in for an interview? Why can't we do that? Just come in, sit down, high def video, hair samples, blood samples. No way this could be fake. Then he leaves. Everybody wins. And
yeah, well,
when he's not looking, put a tracking device on him.
Where?
Well, it's a quick
during the proctological, like, you know,
lower back, cauterize it. That way you can track it. It lives its life. You learn so much more than having one on a slab. And
well, you need both. You wouldn't be able to learn so much about a biological entity just by throwing, you know, a tracking device on it. You know, you need to be able to look at how, you know, its internal body works and, you know, test things that you would only be able to test by opening it up. You know, so yes, you can learn a lot about habitat and behavior
life.
And things like that.
Yeah,
so let me, because this is an endlessly repeating cycle that never finishes. So let me ask
someday
you, David. No, I won't. As a naturalist, one of the things that so I want your opinion on this next statement. One of the things that the TBRC specifically gets a lot of heat for is, you know, how can you say you're quote unquote a conservancy, but you want to kill one, as if we really desperately want to kill one. This idea that conservationists. Part of the act of conservation is sometimes collecting samples of animals. How do you explain that to people who don't, and I agree that if you don't know how it works, there seems to be some illogic there. How do you explain mm-hmm. that to people? What is the purpose of collecting specimens for the purpose of conservation?
Well, this is a really important point to make. I think a lot of people confuse a conservation organization and an animal rights organization. And they're not the same thing at all. You know, conservation, again, is science-based, and in the science of ecology, the unit of importance is not the individual. The unit of importance is the population. And in order to adequately understand, you know, from a scientific point of view, the biology of those organisms, you need sometimes to have specimens that you can study. And wildlife management, which again is based on science and is a big part of conservation, you know, a big piece of that is being able to remove individuals from the population, whether for, you know, overpopulation purposes or for study or, you know, what have you. And so conservation is not anti-kill ever. In fact, hunting is a big piece of conservation. The National Wildlife Federation, a big part of our roots is from hunting and fishing organizations, and that remains true today. Hunters and anglers were the first conservationists, and and people debate that, and you know, that's probably never gonna change. But just a conservation group is not about saving the individual lives of you know, this particular, you know, animal that, you know, I mean, again, we're human beings and we love animals and right. we want to help when we see an injured animal or whatever. But that in this instance, when you were trying to establish the existence of a species, you know, whether or not it has a family or, you know, whatever, there's no data to suggest anything about this. So you can't go to that moral ground until you can actually prove that it exists.
But that's a slippery slope. If these things exist, the odds are pretty strong that they have some type of social unit, probably similar to other higher primates. So you would be affecting that if you shot one. I mean,
But this is my point, Scott. Though I think this is really important. If they exist, and until you tell you show me that they exist, then it's pointless to me to have a conversation about, you know, it's hypothetical what kind of family structure they have if they exist. You know what I'm saying?
There's a
chance that they might be like other primates, and if they do exist, I would have to guess that their populations are really small. But that is all after you prove to me that it exists.
Until then.
You can debate it, but it doesn't. It's not. There's nothing there to debate.
But well, you know what I'm saying, though, that it goes to the other, which leads to the other question. Then we debated this ad nauseum a few shows ago, or two or three shows ago. It's then it's forever the individual, whether he or she wants to pull the trigger themselves or supports that view. It's more important to them that this knowledge is gained than it is that the life of that particular animal. At that point in time.
Well,
that's fair. I mean, I didn't think Brian agreed with
but,
that.
But you make it sound like, when you say it like that, you make it sound like there's just this dispassionate sort of...
No, dude, I'm not saying that you're doing it out of glee or bloodlust.
But you're saying just for the knowledge of knowing. All I can say is what drives me.
You're right. Yeah, I see your point on that. I mean, I don't.
It's what you do with the knowledge, is what I'm saying. It's like once you have the knowledge, then that becomes a tool to further other goals.
To help for conservation. Yeah, and I would agree on that. But again, I would say in this particular instance, because we know, again, if they exist, we know so little about it. How many there are? Are they actually endangered? Are they very endangered? Just to use a little bit, you know. I don't know that I don't think there is this. There needs to be a sense of urgency that there could be other ways to get the body without just plugging one.
So let me. This is actually another question that I want to ask David, and this is sort of more of a moral question from the perspective of a naturalist. If you, and this is a totally hypothetical situation, so it may not even be a fair question, but if you knew there was a population of animals that had not been described. There were four of them left. Let's say it's one of these like weird little ponds that sometimes exist in the desert, and there's a breed of fish in this pond that exists nowhere else in the world, right?
And
you find this little pond, and there's only four of them in there, and you determine that that is not a viable breeding population. Do you take one, or do you let it live and have it not be described that way? What is the moral obligation at that point?
I guess you wouldn't know, you couldn't ask that question because if it was undescribed, that means that we don't really know anything about it. And so how would you know that those are the only four there, you know? Mm-hmm. And so in that scenario, the only option you have is to either study them in situ, like right there where they are, which you can do if you actually can, you know, get a scientist to sit there and observe and document it and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And if that were, if you knew that it was going to disappear and likely you would never see another one in your entire life, then probably, and your goal was to scientifically prove that this species existed, then you would have to take one in that scenario.
The way that I've heard biologists explain this to me, not on the show, But is that if you're in a situation where the animal population is so low that it isn't viable anyway, it's like you're not really doing any harm, because if they're not viable, they're not viable, right? And so taking one makes no difference. They're not going to survive anyway.
That's true. I'm just saying that how would you know if it wasn't viable if you hadn't even proved that the species existed in the first place?
Yeah, my hypothetical is stupid.
I thought it was a really good hypothetical. I think it's a very interesting hypothetical, because you have it still comes down, and since it's a moral, as Ed Bryan said, like a philosophical issue, it's hard to scientifically get the answer that way, but it's, it still comes down to what is more, in that instance, it would be knowledge versus letting a thing live its own God and or nature given life. I mean, I'm going to take its life so I can learn something, or let it live. And when it dies, take it, because you're not going to be preserving it. It's just an issue of what's more important to you, letting it live, or now I've got this knowledge I can spread.
It's fair to say that we've been in this position before, when you look at the scientific knowledge that we have now about the dodo is only because it was there were specimens that were preserved, even though we knew they were being hunted to extinction. The same with the thylacine. About 100 years ago for the thylacine, they were dying out. They were being hunted to extinction. If you're down to the last half dozen or so, do you just let them die, or do you preserve them, take one now and preserve it while it's in good health and can be studied as a dead but otherwise healthy specimen?
And I guess the philosophical conversation comes back to, is there value in understanding as much as you can about that animal as it was and its place in nature that is worth the fact that you're going to take the life of this animal, of which there are only a few left? I mean, what there is, and this gets back to the point I made about, what do you do with that knowledge? In this case, you can't save the animal anymore, but you might understand better how it fits into the ecosystem. You might have a better idea about how the ecosystem is being affected by external.
But then can't you get that once it just dies? Like, let's say if it was a dodo bird thing, wouldn't that be an instance where you could definitely track it, put something on it, let it live, and then when it dies, retrieve the body?
Well, then you got an old dead one, and these things I mean, again, you get into these kind of hypotheticals where I'm not even sure the technology exists or how it works or how you're going to actually collect that thing. And if it dies and it's 20 miles away and it's predated by the time you get there, then it's not worth anything to you, because all you have is a carcass and a few feathers. And I mean, you have to basically be 10 feet behind it all the time waiting for it to drop dead.
Losing sight of the forest for the trees, maybe, because all of this is predicated on the fact that something actually exists. And again, as a agnostic, as somebody, from the outside world that has not seen one of these things, and, you have to, before you can have any of these conversations, you need to prove that it exists.
This is a bit
that's where I would disagree as any human. You're saying if all you are in your life is a scientist, that's your number one concern in your life, then yes. But if that takes precedence over compassion toward other living beings, then yes, that's where the issue is. It's like, I think that this scenario that Brian brought up is really an interesting one, because it's like there's three left. You know that to a reasonable certainty. So it's more important that other people learn about this than just to let it live its life. I just personally find that so abhorrent. I just think that it's like, I don't know.
Well, again, I think it gets down to what you're going to do with that knowledge. What I'm going to say is that you're not going to collect information about this mythological, hypothetical animal that isn't of value beyond their essentially dead species at this point, right? I mean, you're going to learn things about the natural world by taking this animal that will die anyway, and their species will die out in this hypothetical situation. You're going to learn about the entire natural world or some little piece of it by having this specimen. And if you don't collect it when you have a chance, then you miss that opportunity forever and it's gone.
Yeah, but again, it comes back to that thing of convenience. Well, I can't really track it. I could, but it's going to be too much money, so let's kill it. But again, I don't mean to pad the argument by that it's one of of gleeful non-compassion toward the animal. But it just comes off so cold. It's just like, it's just cold, man.
I think that's science.
Well, I mean, I think science is cold. You can science be scientific, but, you know, it's a choice a person makes. It's not like, well, that's science, so I have to do it. No, you're choosing to do that. And it isn't the only way to do it. There are harder, more time-consuming ways. But again, that comes back to the issue of personal convenience or inconvenience and, you know, knowledge. I mean, I'm open to arguments where if the data is there to suggest this is going to be impacting greatly the lives of others, let's say, like Brian was saying, in a particular ecosystem, but that would have to be, you know, pretty. This is a great discussion, by the way.
Getting back to Bigfoot then, for that matter, because I mean, basically you just did. I would say that in my opinion, in the opinion of the people that I work with on this, on a, you know, I'm not going to say professional level, because we're certainly not professionals, but the work that we do, we believe that there is a viable population here. So taking one animal is not going to destroy their chances of survival. But what we do not know is how they're thriving. We don't know how they're living. We don't know what impact modern man is having on their habitat. We don't know any of those things. We know nothing about how they live. So what we're saying, and the argument I've made 120 times on this show, is that when you collect that one, it unlocks the potential to learn all kinds of things about them. Because all of a sudden, every naturalist, primatologist, biologist, literally in the world, is going to want to come to North America and learn about
and
this.
And take another sample. We just need one more. Let's kill one. You know, how many times has that happened in the history of mankind in relation to the animal kingdom?
All right. But again, I mean, so what? You know, I mean, again, if you're approaching it from the established scientific point of view, that doesn't matter, because again, the unit of importance is not the individual. And I won't argue with you that there is a value judgment there. But you know, the scientific way to go about doing it and the reasoning behind it is exactly what Brian just described.
Well, yeah,
I can't help feeling that what we're discussing here with Scott is Scott's detailed plans on how he's going to spend his lottery winnings before he won the lottery.
What? Explain that. I didn't understand that at all.
Well, you're talking, and you do this time and time again. You talk about how we need to study these creatures and how we need to understand them. It's a bit, to me, it just sounds like somebody who's making plans as to how he's going to spend his lottery winnings before he wins the lottery.
And so you're saying the only way to learn anything about these animals is we have to kill one. There's no other option.
Until you prove that it exists, it is not an animal.
See, that's ridiculous. That's a totally self-based, you care more about what other people think about you than life of this particular animal.
I think the point he's making, and I don't want to pile on, because I didn't invite Dave Ron to beat Scott to crap.
Get him.
But what I'm saying is, I mean, and you're the one who is constantly throwing the scientific thing back. You know, in the last show, when I said that I saw two Bigfoot running up a hill, and you were saying, well, that wasn't a very scientific way to think about that, because you didn't actually see two Bigfoot, you saw two black shapes.
That's true.
So what I'm saying, dude, I'll give you that. But when you're talking about personal experiences, the scientific thing is kind of hard to factor in. What I'm saying is, as someone who's constantly throwing back the scientific method, this is the scientific method, and you completely reject it, which is fine. That's totally your right. But I just want to call that out to say that when 90% of the time you're like, well, that's not very scientific, and you're often right when you say that, in this case, you completely reject the scientific method.
How did you call back so quick? That was amazing. Hello?
Did we get cut off?
Yeah.
Likely story.
No. Dude, seriously, it's automatic. Does it automatically call back? Because it just called back.
I don't know.
What I'm saying
is...
Did
you hear it? Because it was brilliant what I said.
It
was brilliant. Very eloquent.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, perfect. You probably cut me off. So anyway. What we agree on, if a body was found, it's the method by which a body is gotten. That's my issue. I agree. If a guy hits him with a truck tomorrow, there it is. Boom. We've got the proof. I also think that in time, the DNA is going to get more and more specific, and we're going to be able to do verification of the species. I mean, this is what Disatel told us. He felt that it's going to be happening. So again, it's this argument of, well, there's a sense of urgency. We have to get one out, and I don't buy that at all.
Well, I would say that the biggest sense of urgency comes from what we were talking about a little while ago, and that is, you know, that every time that there is some bungled proof, you know, i.e. Melville Ketchum or hoaxes, that it makes it less likely that the scientific world is going to pay attention to this stuff.
Yep.
And so to me, that creates a sense of urgency, because the longer we go, you know, decades and decades of you know, blob squatch photos and junk science and costumes, it just makes it that much, it makes the bar go even higher before you can, again, prove that these things exist and protect them.
Yeah, but like what Disatel said when we interviewed him, he made this point. He goes, even if you have, you know, let's say five more Melville Ketchums, and we can all hope to God that doesn't happen, come down the pike. If Dave Disatel sitting with his connection to GenBank, and he's got a DNA sample there, and he plugs it in, and it doesn't match, and he says it'll literally happen like in 3 seconds, because I think he said something like that, and there is boom, this is primate, it's off this particular branch. There is the hard data that can be shared with any other geneticist who wants to look at it. So it doesn't matter if it's 400 other, if Dave Disatel, a Harvard educated guy, or Sykes gets that sample. So where
Well, Scott, Melba said that GenBank wouldn't take that. She told it. She said it.
Well, whatever. That's Melba. I'm talking about someone who's established like Disatel or Sykes. If they get that,
Has anybody told Melba that she's got to plug the computer into the phone line before she uploads anything?
No, probably not. I'm not disagreeing with you, Scott. What I'm saying is that you've got, you know, as I think David referenced earlier, the thing about science is it has to be repeatable. So whatever I find, you have to be able to find independently of me and back me up when I say that I found it. And also, you've got, especially with DNA, you've got to know the chain of evidence. You've got to know. Especially if you're talking about DNA that is similar, that might be similar to human DNA in some way. And I'm not saying that Melba has anything. In fact, I would go so far as to say she's making shit up at this point. But if you've got a DNA sample that is close to us, then that is even more important. You need to have samples of all those people in between. So what I'm saying is, I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm saying that I think the likelihood of getting a big enough sample that it can be repeatably tested and proven to be the same every time with that chain of evidence, it's going to get really, really hard to do that. So I'm not saying it's impossible, and I'm not saying that I wouldn't try to do it, but it isn't like as soon as Disatel gets a piece of hair, you know, we're golden. It isn't that simple.
Nor did I suggest that. I'm saying it still comes back to what's important to whatever individual is doing the study or is interested in this topic, and what are the priorities, and just it's not you do. I'm just against the argument that says you have to, and you just agree.
No, we agree. I mean,
to shoot one for Bigfoot.
If I found a dead one that had been predated by coyotes, and I could pick up a femur and a skull or whatever, I'd be set, right? And that's a perfectly.
Yeah, or a car, you know that you
right,
know, or
totally.
I mean,
right.
The one that would please everybody, I think, seriously, would be. And again. Yeah, relatively improbable, but who knows? Because we think they're probably there is, you know, one that had died and is decaying and whatever, and they got the carcass, and holy crap, there's one. Actually, I wanted to say one quick thing. See, then it brings up the interesting scenario. Let's say that happens. Somebody finds one that's been hit by a car or whatever. Now you have a type specimen. There is going to be proof. Scientists come in, they look at, oh, God, this is a new species. It's upright. It's blah, blah, blah. It fits the stories of Bigfoot. It looks like Bigfoot, in fact, is real. So at that point, you don't really have any excuse, do you, to want to go kill one? Another one.
Well, me personally, no. My organization, probably not.
Or advocating that.
Right.
I mean, why?
Yeah.
What would be?
But you're right that probably others would want to go and collect a second specimen and, you know, and collect it from a different population. So yes, you're absolutely right that it does sort of open up that slippery slope. But again, that's how science works. So I don't disagree that's how it's worked, but
I think that it's been done. But it's
so,
you know, I don't know.
You're
it
getting,
seems like
you're,
we can be a little more creative,
but you're getting
a little
very,
more patient
you're
without
getting,
having to pull a bunch away or cage them or, you know, all that.
It seems
nonsense.
To me you're getting dangerously close to the argument that because the first one may lead to more, then we shouldn't get the first one and just leave them alone and let them do whatever they're going to do and let nature take its course. Which I hear. I mean, I've heard that argument by people. Like, I you know, there are people out there, and I, at least I respect them for being, you know, consistent in the way they think. You know, I don't think one should be taken because as soon as it's proven, then more will be killed, and then...
Well, I'd be more worried about the jackasses who were, you know...
Oh, good luck to the jackasses.
We need the gallbladder because it helps with my prostate. You know, those, you know, that you get the stealthy guys who get out there, you know what I mean, the illegal hunters.
Good luck to those guys. That's all. Good luck.
Yeah.
You go out there.
I was
going to
say, I mean, I don't know if these things are real based on all the anecdotal reports that we hear. I'm not sure that would be a huge concern because if they are real, they've done a pretty damn good job at staying out of
Scott,
our line of view.
You would be happy because more of those guys would shoot each other than they would shoot actual Bigfoot. So I think that would be.
Of course, if enough people believe dodgy DNA reports, there'll be enough idiots that do believe they're real
and
to go out shooting.
Start shooting each other. Yeah. Well, no, because
wait a minute.
It seems to me that what Scott's saying is that whilst we have an established scientific method of collecting a sample, that he doesn't want to do that sort of science and wants to make up a new kind of science. And I'm just wondering, I'm racking my brains to figure out where I've heard this before recently.
Oh, ouch.
Dude, all I'm saying is, all I'm saying is the method by which a sample is gotten. I just think, personally, I just think it's terribly cold. And granted, yeah, it's been done in science, but it doesn't mean I agree. It's not the only way that a specimen can be gotten. Everybody agrees with that. And the reason it's done is generally it seems to be for expedience. And that seems super cold. I mean, it can be cold and that, well, you know, we don't really know if they're just plug one. Shoot one. Which is
as I've said before, I completely reject that. I think that the what would be the interesting conversation. Again, now we're speaking in hypotheticals. Let's just say one of them gets run over by a logging truck in Oregon,
gotcha.
And done. We're done, right? We've proven them. Here it is. It's badly mangled, but there it is. It's clearly not a guy in a suit. It's clearly not an orangutan. This is a whole new thing we've never seen before.
I think Hieronymus.
What would be interesting. Well, that's why he got hit, because he was so slow at this point. He's old.
Yeah.
The interesting conversation that would come out of that is exactly your point, is like the ethics of continuing to kill a higher primate, not the, you know, it looks like us, it walks like us. I mean, then you get this really interesting conversation that I think would happen in the scientific world, but, you know, to like everyone else's point on the show, that conversation isn't going to happen. Until that first one.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to make the point that you guys, it's not like you guys, you have to do it this way, but it's not, you're choosing.
Oh, I've never said you have to do it this way. And
but, I know, you agree, but I'm just saying, but
no, what it boils
what
down to
is being put into the alternate ways.
What it boils down to is your priority with regard,
yes.
Like what your take is on the badly you need to do it now. Because we could very easily keep going the way we have, and in 45 years we'll still be having this conversation, and I hope that
and we'd be on show 281.
Right.
That's what's wrong with that.
Or
come on, man.
I have to make one correction. Uh-oh. Brian, you just said, you know, if these things are, you know, walking around and looking like humans, and I would say that that's not accurate, because we know that they actually look more like Wookiees.
True.
Yes.
Oh, well, let's get to that. Because I do want to get to questions, but first I want to make sure that we cover some of this news. So what David was referring to there in a artfully done segue is that, you know, again, we're back to the very sleepy Sasquatch. What was her name again? I can't remember.
Jeez. Matilda.
Matilda, the very sleepy Sasquatch, sleeping openly on a hillside. Some images leaked out of what are purportedly the face.
Dude, quick question. In the Erickson Project video that's on YouTube, who is the guy talking? Is he the director who goes, well, we stumbled upon it? And
yeah, I don't know who that guy is.
Who is that guy? That guy is so obviously full of
it. I don't know. But so these pictures have leaked out that supposedly show the face. And our you know, Bill Munns, who has a reputation as a guy who, okay, well, whatever, he knows what he's talking about, and he very, you know, conveniently found some commercial Wookiee masks that apparently look exactly like the face of Matilda the Very Sleepy Sasquatch. And what's interesting is that there was sort of a debate going on about whether or not this was genuinely from the Erickson footage. Jeff Meldrum came out and essentially confirmed it and said that the footage he saw early on, he was one of the guys that I had heard had seen it but was sworn to secrecy. He said, and he didn't tell me, so he didn't break his secrecy swearing. He said that this is the face that he saw in the video, and apparently it is a Wookiee mask. And so Bigfoot, again, if you use the sort of catchium logic of if I say it on the internet, it's true, Bigfoot are Wookiees, which is a pretty big headline.
Or maybe that's, I mean, Lucas was prescient when he created the Chewbacca character, is that, you know, based, maybe he had a cousin who actually had an up-close view of a Bigfoot.
Here you go.
And
what I heard, what I read
on
the internet.
I think George Lucas really is the mastermind behind this whole thing, and all it is really a big marketing thing, because he knew that he would be relaunching the whole Star Wars franchise with Disney.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
It all is just a conspiracy theory.
What I read on the internet was the Wookiee in Star Wars was actually a Sasquatch, that it wasn't a guy in a suit. It was a trained Bigfoot.
Yeah, I mean,
that's what happens if you don't kill them for science. They go into acting.
That's what they should have done, is actually shoot Matilda right there, defenseless, sitting very stealthily.
Well, they should have, actually.
Well,
but
again,
anyway,
if they wanted to prove that these creatures existed and wanted to not be the butt of jokes of the scientific community and the public at large, yes, they should have, you know, because that's where this subject stands. And again, I'm not saying that I fall into that category, but, you know, as an outsider looking in, sometimes, like I was saying, I think people that are really wound up in this whole phenomenon lose sight of the forest for the trees. You got to sometimes take a few steps back and look at it from the big picture. And that, I think, it will help you make those decisions, maybe moral decisions, on how you who believe that these things exist, you know, how you're going to respond or what you're going to advocate for. Because it's really easy to enter into the world of, yes, we all believe, and then to debate these things. But, you know, for somebody that doesn't necessarily believe, it's all words until you show me a body, or until the scientific community accepts whatever scientific data you give them. You know what I'm saying? So I think that's important to say, because as I, again, listen to podcasts and read and watch TV shows and all that kind of stuff, from the outside, that's one of the biggest things that strikes me, is just, you know, so much time and energy is spent sort of having these insular debates and arguments, and until no one's going to pay attention to that, is what I guess I'm trying to say, until you prove that these things exist. And that means that probably is the top priority for people interested in this field, or should be. Otherwise, you're just going to keep having your circular arguments with each other until forever.
Well, now I'm depressed.
All right.
Thanks
well,
a lot.
Now, I got a scenario for you, Dave. Okay. Let's say you're at home, you're sleeping, and alien comes down, right? Call him Merv the alien. And, you know, he's from another galaxy, comes down, and he gets in your room, and he observes you, and he gets videotape of you, and he goes back to Glarkon. He goes, dude, look at this. This unusual, kind of similar to us, but they're going to whatever. Dude, I'm sorry. That's fine, but you're going to have to kill one for me. Oh, okay. So he goes back, he kills you, and he takes him back. Now Glarkon, and they now can be confirmed that you, in fact, exist. What do you think about that?
Well,
story?
That would suck. That would suck for me, and yeah. I, of course, personally wouldn't want that to happen. But okay. I wouldn't argue that Merv was not following the scientific method. You know,
at least Merv was being consistent.
My only, and I'll just do the last thing I say on it. It's a difference between the scientific method, as far as what I understand the scientific method to be, is physical proof that something is being verified. That you have to, we're dealing with the physical world, the natural world, and you have to have indisputable physical evidence, which we all agree is a body. The issue is how it's attained. That's the only issue I have. So it's the scientific method to shoot a specimen, I completely disagree. Because it's not the only way to do it.
We're not saying
that. But it's
that.
The most effective way,
right,
and the standard way.
Right. I mean, I'm
not disagreeing with that either.
I am the happiest man on earth if we find one who died of a coronary disease, right? I mean, there's nothing. I would be thrilled, especially thrilled if it died, you know, within the last 20 minutes so that it wasn't all chewed up.
It on. That would be
whatever. I would be happy with that. And nobody has ever said that that isn't the case. But the thing is, if that was going to happen, you know, if it was so easy to find them just dropping dead, then it would have happened. But we've been talking about this for, you know, since the 50s in popular culture.
Well, yeah, that's right. And I know we're going circular again, so it's coming back to that issue of convenience. And
so let's just say,
Merv
comes down and he realizes that, you know, we don't know about Bigfoot because we've never found one, but he's seen that the population is cut in half in the last 50 years. Well, you know, whatever. We'll just keep waiting for one of them to drop dead
You dropped out there.
Your friend, the alien from another planet who knew about Bigfoot because, you know, he's got advanced sensors on his spaceship. But cool. So he knows about Bigfoot and he knows how many there are. And since, you know, the first, you know, cast was found back in the 50s, you know, their population has dropped by half because of pressure from human population growth. But whatever, we'll just keep waiting for one of them.
A total assumption on your part, because there's no way you could get Glark unless you tap into the ship via hacking.
His password is password, for God's sake. It's just spelled in his language.
You know what, guys, this gets into the question that I posted before your last show, that you guys actually, you know, talked a little bit about, which is what, you know, prompted me to email you, Brian, which ended up me being on the show. And my comment or my question for you guys was this notion that, yes, you can't disprove that something exists. You can prove that it exists, but you can't disprove it, right? But my question was, you know, how much time has to go by of people looking and failing, you know, or trying to prove and failing that something exists before that length of time and that effort does become a kind of disproof. And I have to say that from the outside looking in, as much as I would think it would be amazing if an animal like this existed, the more time that goes by and the more I hear people talking about all this stuff, the less, I have to say, my to use percentages the way that Scott's does, you know, the percentage of me that I could think of that this might actually be real goes down. And I think that does add a sense of urgency.
Dave, you have one in your garage and you feed it and take care of it. This could be the biggest irony. It's like, I couldn't kill him. He's my friend. I call him Murray. And I don't want to release him because I know he's going to get zooed. This would make a great start. Sorry to interrupt. Okay, go ahead.
The problem with the question, David, is that you're asking it from the point of view of yourself rather than somebody who's invested a huge portion of their life in the search for something like this. Right. And when you've made that sort of investment in something like this, you're not going to give up. And when you do eventually give up and die, other people will have come in and they'll have invested 10, 15, 20 years. And there comes a point where they think, well, any day now. It's like doing the lottery tickets. You get into this routine of doing them, and you kind of never think that you're actually going to win. But you don't want to stop because you know what your numbers were. Right. And if those numbers come up and you haven't done them because you stopped doing them last week.
I think it makes total sense, and I agree that there's a level of faith involved. You know, and again, if you, like you know, both Scott and Brian have had visual encounters with this thing that they think is a Bigfoot, right? So I'm certainly not going to tell you that you didn't see what you say you think you saw, you know? I mean, I wasn't there, so I don't know. But and I understand how that sort of faith, whether you've seen one or not, drives it. But I guess I'm just saying that from the outside perspective and from the scientific perspective, I mean, if this were any other subject and you tried for, well, let's just take the last 40 years, to prove that something was the way that you're saying it is, and you still have not done it yet, that just is going to cause the scientific world to lose interest in that subject, right, or conclude, for lack of any other better evidence, that your hypothesis is not correct.
So I would say two things. I think your question can only be answered by an individual. I mean, there is no way that, like, as a group, all humans will come to the conclusion at some point that, well, we've looked long enough and it's not there, so obviously it's not real. Because alluding to what Paul said and what you said about our own personal experiences, people have personal experiences. And some of them are completely bogus. You're right. Some people see a, you know, a beaver and they think it's a Bigfoot. And so for the rest of their lives, they believe in Bigfoot because they saw this little hairy thing running across the road. But some people have experiences that are harder to explain. Some people have experiences that they believe are pretty conclusive. So it doesn't really matter how long we go without, you know, proving it, quote unquote, because for some people it's done, whether or not that's valid. And then you're going to have another group of people. The people that I really have questions about, and it's not because I question their sanity or anything, but, you know, people like John Green, who has been in this field since, like, Moses, like, seriously, right? He's been doing this forever.
1861, his first book came out.
He's never seen one. I don't know, as far as I know. He's never had an experience, but he continues to be as active as he can be, as interested as he can be. I mean, up till, you know, an advanced age, he was active in the field. I saw him in 2003 in Willow Creek. He was there.
He looked sad in that gorilla costume, though. It was a little weak.
What keeps people like that going is a perfectly valid question. But we can't prove that they don't exist because we haven't found one yet. And the other point that I would make is, I don't believe that if you look at the actual amount of effort put into it by, you know, if you take the number of people times the number of hours times, you know, whatever, to come to how much actual time has been spent looking for these things over the past, say, since 1950, hardly any.
Yeah.
You know, and especially if you take into account, like, what kinds of equipment did they deploy? You know, how many of them were there? It is not the case that, you know, sort of like with the Yeti research and that thing that we posted that you pointed out to me from Slate earlier in the week, where the U.S. State Department was actually like saying, here's what you're going to do if you find a Yeti. You know, here are the steps to take. There were a lot of guys looking for Yetis, and there was a concerted effort over multiple years by people with resources, and they didn't find anything. And then it sort of disappeared essentially evaporated as a thing. I don't believe the same kind of effort's been put into North America. That's my own personal belief.
I would say, and coupled with what Brian just said, which I agree with, everything you said, is, and we've talked about it on the show a lot, is, are the amounts of land just in the U.S., Pacific Northwest, I would say even specifically, and then crazy amount of stuff up in British Columbia, that in my opinion, and I think other, you know, people like Goodall has said this, a primatologist I talked to at the Calgary Zoo once, that there is ample room for a smart, higher primate, relatively in small numbers, to stay hidden. I mean, and again, then you add to that the history of higher primate discovery relative to a lot of other animals has always been a long process. Orangutans, mountain gorillas, I think even lowland gorillas, so hundreds of years went by. And then if you add on to that also, but you get people who, I think the skeptics will look at this, oh, but we're so advanced now. We have so much technology. And I go, you know what? When you get into a canopied forest with steeply, steep slopes, thousands of steep slopes, and you have something back in there that's probably bigger, faster than a mountain gorilla, less numbered than the ones in Rwanda, it isn't that hard to believe at all.
No. I mean, I would say probably one of the finest pieces of night vision equipment a consumer can buy in the United States, right? It's not what they're currently using in the military, but it's fantastic. You know, when I get out into the woods of Oklahoma, I'm not talking about Vietnam.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Oklahoma. There are times when I can't see 10 feet in front of me, and I'm using a piece of advanced technology, you know, the kind of thing that guys like John Green only wish he had in 1968. So it isn't, you know, as I think any scientist would agree, there's a certain amount of being in the right place at the right time with the right equipment. And I guess my point is, I don't believe that sufficient resources have really been expended by the people who know how to use them over the right amount of time to be able to say with any degree of fairness that because it has not been found yet, it does not exist. But that doesn't mean that a person, an individual, couldn't say, you know what, this is crap. And I don't blame them. I don't blame anybody who's looking at this field, who got into it because they were watching Finding Bigfoot or whatever, and now they've dug a little deeper and they've seen this, like, just miasma of craziness that
what
we're
was
having.
That word?
Miasma.
How do you spell that? That's an awesome. Yeah.
I have no idea. Look it up.
It is a good word.
But I wouldn't begrudge someone who's coming into this field now going like, this is complete crap. These guys are nuts.
But you know what?
And that was my point, I think, you know, in raising that question. It wasn't necessarily why an individual would stick with believing that this is true even after they haven't been able to prove it. I was just talking in the general sense, and honestly from kind of the outsider scientific-minded person looking in, you know, if the community, the Bigfoot community, wants that world to believe in them and to invest in them and give them the benefit of the doubt, you need to understand that the longer it goes without concrete, provable evidence that these things exist, the more likely it is for that outside, you know, otherwise open-minded person is going to say, well, you know, how long do we need to keep looking and not finding before we can conclude that there's probably nothing there? And I just, you know, just sharing that observation with the Bigfoot community, I think it's an important perspective to keep in mind.
But from a naturalist's point of view, which of course is where you're coming from, David, does it matter? Surely anything that gets people out into the woods and closer to nature and understanding a bit more about what's in the forest is good.
Yeah,
and the fact that they're not being eaten by 7-foot-tall apes is probably good too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another thing that brings me to this topic, something that I'm interested in. You know, and lots of has been written about this, I think, but this whole notion that regardless of whether or not there is a biological animal that still exists today that fits this description, that the notion of sort of wild being outside of the control of modern humanity as a symbol maybe of wilderness and maybe some sort of collective unconscious, you know, sort of our connection to nature and the need for nature, I think is a really fascinating way to look at this whole subject. And, you know, from that point of view, again, to me, it doesn't matter if they exist. It matters that, you know, there's something unknown out there in the human psyche that draws us into nature and causes us maybe to respect nature and want to learn more about nature. You know, from that point of view, you know, again, I don't care if it's real, as long as people are getting out and experiencing the natural world. Because the only way we have that old saying, you know, you only protect what you love and you only love what you know. And so by getting out, you know, if you're out trout fishing or you're out looking for Bigfoot, you're still out in nature, right? And so I think that is a good thing. The only thing I would say, though, the only caveat is that, and this is why, again, no conservation group is going to say, oh, let's protect the Sasquatch. Because you know what? There are a long list of existing animals that we know are real that desperately need our help. And so if you're going to go out into the woods and spend all of your time and your energy and your resources and your, you know, your sort of philanthropy towards something that might not even exist, I would rather you put those efforts in to helping the species that we actually know exists that desperately need our help. So that would be the only kind of negative of what you're talking about, you know, getting people outdoors as a good thing, regardless of, you know, why they're getting out there.
Hey, so David, I got a quick question for you. Do you think, as someone who leans, where would you put your probability rating on Sasquatches actually existing? I mean, I by the way, my current PGF is a hoax, is 87.83%. Where would you, can you put it into a number like that?
You know, I couldn't give you an exact number, but it would be a high, very high that that this is not a real thing.
Okay.
So existing, I
just was going to say, my question then, did you think that what, because, you know, I leave open that possibility too. I mean, I'm 99.999% convinced that there are some of these things still around. But would you say that what could maybe be along with, and I agree with what you're talking about, like an archetype, you know, wild man archetype in our psyche, that it could be something where there were things like this that our ancestors, maybe going back 10, 15,000 years, actually did encounter, and then these stories pass on, you know, and that to this day, coupled with that kind of psychic archetype, gives us these tales.
That seems a way more plausible theory as to what is behind this phenomenon. Because, again, as you guys talked about last show, there is a phenomenon going on, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's something there. Whether or not it's a real living, breathing creature, I can't say. From what I know, I would say that the likelihood of that is very, 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 very slim. To me, it's much more plausible that what you just described is what's happening, that, you know, we do have a, we know that other human species existed alongside of modern humans, Homo sapiens, right? So I don't think it's beyond, I think it's very plausible that we have some sort of innate knowledge.
Genetic memory?
What's the right word I'm looking for? You know,
genetic memory, like, maybe?
Yeah, genetic memory. I just think, you know, if that were the case,
why would it be isolated to North America?
Oh, I don't.
Why wouldn't everybody in Europe be having the same?
Or where the rainfall is high in North America? I mean, why aren't they seeing saber-toothed tigers? You know, why aren't they seeing?
I think that if there is a sort of an ancestral sort of memory or reaction that we have to this notion of another sort of, you know, large upright bipedal primate that's walking around the woods, that it would be more universal. Well, I think it is. I mean, people all over the world, you know, Yowies and Orang Pendex and all the, you know, I mean, there's some South American ones too, right? So, you know, I mean, I'm not talking about exact sightings. I'm just talking about, if you're going to argue that possibly there's some, again, sort of ancestral knowledge of these things that maybe once existed but no longer, that is influencing how we interpret what we see in the real world, I think that has, I mean, I don't know how you would prove that, but that to me, it sounds a lot more of a plausible theory than this, you know, 7 to 12 foot tall, you know, primate running around in areas that are, you know, sometimes relatively close to people. And, you know, and again, I'm not saying that that's not true, but
he's not running. No evidence to say.
It's not 12 feet tall. So, don't be ridiculous. 12 feet tall. It's eight and a half tops. So I want to, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say a couple other things. I want to get back to, you know, the notion of, you know, whether or not these things could exist. I would totally agree that they could exist in terms of the amount of available habitat in North America and food sources. You know, I would agree with that. And that's one of the reasons why I keep an open mind. I don't know. I mean, maybe there is something out there like that. And I do think that given the circumstances that Scott went through, you know, the amount of available habitat and low population numbers and this, you know, sort of extreme ability to hide from humans and intelligence that, you know, in theory, sure, I think that something like that could exist from a biological point of view. That doesn't mean it does, but, you know, that to me is what keeps me able to having an open mind despite all the bullshittery that goes on in sort of the Bigfoot world. It's that, and it's hearing stories like you, both of your sighting stories. That's the kind of thing where, you know, I've never met you guys in person, but, you know, I have listened to your show and I have a level of trust in you guys that you're not making this stuff up. And particularly the stuff, Brian, that you've talked about in Area X. I mean, I find that really, really fascinating and compelling. And I'm so happy that, you know, someone has done what you guys have done, you know, tried to be a little bit more meticulous and long-term and have protocols and, you know, observe this stuff and record it. I can't tell you what you saw, or I have no explanation whatsoever for all of the experiences that you've described, you know, the rock throwing and, you know, the banging in the cabin and all that kind of stuff. You know, but again, that's not enough for me to say that. Sure. I believe, you know, sure. But I'm so thrilled about it. And you sharing those stories, I think is so important, and sharing them in the way that you share them, because it, you know, you're a sane, credible person as far as I can tell. And so,
well, as far as you can
that,
tell, I'm sitting here in a clown outfit right now.
I think they said that about Ted Bundy too, didn't
he
they?
He did. He seemed like a really nice guy. All his neighbors said he was such.
But you get my point.
That.
You know, hearing those,
point,
those
right.
stories from people that you know, that you have a level of confidence in is huge. It can't really be overstated. And, you know, a show like Finding Bigfoot for me, I mean, yeah, at this point, it's kind of, I mean, it's formulaic, like all TV shows like this are. Like my Animal Planet series was formulaic. So I'm not faulting them on that. But, you know, there's only so much you can watch of pretty much the same exact thing every week. The thing that I actually enjoy at this point about watching that show is hearing those anecdotes. And some of them, again, seem kind of crazy, but some of them don't.
Yeah.
And I think that's what really brings, no matter what you believe in terms of whether or not this is a real species or it's just a total hoax or whatever, I think it's those stories that are the things that's the thing that keeps people's interest You know, unless you've actually had a sighting yourself. But that for me is, you know, I could sit and hear Bigfoot stories, you know, for hours and hours and hours, whether or not these animals actually existed. So,
well, I think from a purely personal standpoint, one of the most sort of encouraging things that I've heard since we've been talking about X on the show, and it's, you know, my experiences have become public, is hearing people say what you did. And that's just personally very satisfying to say, well, you know, I wasn't really sure until I heard someone like you, who it sounds pretty reasonable. And I'm not saying that I am the one that everyone should listen to, and because I said it, it's true. But it's nice to hear people say that, at least from a, you know, purely personal standpoint. I also think that you know, the value of stories is one. That's why BFRO's website is number one when you type the word Bigfoot into Google, right? And Matt Moneymaker knows that. It's all about those stories. It's all about, you know, I just, and I was there at one point, you know, when back in the early 2000s, when I was just getting back into this sort of as an interest, I would spend a lot of time on the BFRO site reading these stories. That's what I think. That's what people do. They tell stories to each other, and there's just something really deep in our minds that reacts well to that.
Which, of course, makes you wonder why they don't format the website a bit easier, a little bit better, so that you can read.
Well, that website stuff's hard. So I want to get to the listener questions, and I want to get to Sam's. Sam had two really good questions, I thought, and I wanted to get to those since he was not able to join us today. Sam's question to you, David, was, how do we as proponents of science in Bigfootery do a better job of creating amateur naturalists / biologists, or quote-unquote citizen naturalists, to steal from Jeff Meldrum? Also, what, if any, public resources are you aware of for someone wishing to increase our scientific acumen when it comes to biology and ecology?
Well, great questions. And I, to take the first one, you know, I think it's so critically important to get kids outside. And as I referenced before, a lot of the work that the National Wildlife Federation does is really focused on connecting people, the kids in particular, to nature. And to go off on a little bit of a tangent for a minute, you know, the average American kid in America, the average school-age kid in America is spending almost 8 full hours a day indoors every day, sedentary, in front of some kind of electronic screen. You know, they're on computers, they're texting, they're video games, they're watching TV. By the time a kid in America goes to kindergarten, they've already watched 5,000 hours of television. That's enough to get a college degree.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
there's an obvious, and you know, there's nothing wrong with TV and video games and all those things, but clearly I think things are out of balance.
Right.
And so I think the best way to create a a population or generation of people that has a clue about the natural world is to get them outside, and for parents to start making choices and making decisions that help foster that, because the kids aren't going to put down the technology. It boils down to parents that care about this stuff enough to say, you know, we're going to limit this and you are going to go outside and things like that. And so I think that is really, really important for creating, like I said, sort of a literate, when it comes to the natural world, populace. And that's, I mean, it can't be understated how important that is. Again, going back to that old saying, you only protect what you love and you only love what you know. You know, we're basically taken away the opportunity for a few generations at this point of ever really knowing the natural world. And we are getting to the point where I think that some of that knowledge that used to be common is going away. I mean, an average American kid could probably name 100 corporate logos, but probably no birds or trees that live literally right in their neighborhood.
Right.
So that's kind of scary. And I think, again, that's why we focus on trying to get kids outside as much as possible. So, you know, to be more specific, you know, make it a point in your life to go outside, you know, whether you're an adult, whether you have kids, you know, go on a walk, you know, start a birding list. You know, it could be really simple. You don't have to go from not being into nature to doing wilderness excursions. You know, I mean, nature's all around us, even in the middle of cities and towns. So it's about honing your observation skills and, you know, maybe picking up a field guide or even an electronic field guide on your iPhone, you know?
Right.
So, I think but it really, what it boils down to is that we have to make a choice. And part of what my goal as a professional is to educate people about the state of affairs so that we maybe create a little bit of a sense of urgency about this and get people to really pay attention to it. Because, again, I think anyone would agree that those numbers that I just shared are pretty scary.
No, I think that's very well said. I know from my own personal experience, when I was getting into this field, or quote-unquote getting into this field, getting back into this interest, one of the things I did was buy a book of animal tracks. And what that does is, obviously Bigfoot wasn't in there, but using those kind of skills, getting a birding book to identify birds or whatever, it trains you to observe. And I think that's a really important thing. So when you have a book with animal tracks, you look down, you see a little mark in the ground. I'm not a tracker or anything, but it's really great to be able to look down and know what that was. You know,
a deer
versus a moose versus a whatever. You can say, oh, that looks like a cat, not a dog, and I know that because of X, Y, or Z, right? I think that's great advice. I think that was very well said.
I have the solution for this, Brian. Given your profession. We need some of your programmers to develop a nature walk video game.
Yeah.
So the kids that are in front of these TV screens can sit at their Xbox or their iPad. They won't actually have to go outside at all. They can just pretend that they're walking, and it'll be great.
But you know, it's funny that
we could make millions out of this.
Yeah.
Because, that's a suggestion that I have heard so many times over the years, you know, and internal discussions on just that, you know, like how are we going to get kids excited about nature? I think it's a very valid and legitimate strategy that we as conservationists have to accept. And that is that you need to meet people where they are. We can, you know, talk until we're blue in the face about, you know, get kids camping and when they're out camping, we're going to teach them about nature. But if kids aren't camping and they're sitting inside playing video games, you're never going to reach the critical masses of people that you need to reach in order to kind of affect the change at the level that we're trying to affect. So I think it's actually a completely legitimate way is to, again, meet people where they are. And, you know, at National Wildlife Federation, we do this. We have apps based on Ranger Rick Kids Magazine. We've got a kids magazine. You know, these are things that people do inside. The important part is how you build it.
Right.
And are you building it in a way that does increase scientific and biological literacy? And are you doing it in a way that will serve as a catalyst to get people outside? So I think it's really easy to sit in your ivory tower as a conservationist and say, you know, this is what people should be doing, and I'm going to ignore, you know, the media and the electronics that are distracting people. You know, that you're never going to get where you want to get doing that. And I'll tell you, I've, over the years, being working in media, you know, I work in entertainment media. That's what I've been doing for the last 8 years. You know, hosting TV shows and, you know, blogging and doing TV and radio appearances and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I've had colleagues say, you know, we've got an opportunity to pitch a show to X Network. You know, this is me saying to them, you know, help me come up with some really great ideas that feed back into our mission and our programs and our message. And I've had people say to me, I'm too busy living a green lifestyle to watch TV, so I can't help you. And it's like, give me, like, I'm not trying to reach you. You're already our choir. I'm trying to reach the great unwashed masses of Americans that are sitting on their sofas and, again, couldn't tell the difference between a blue jay and a bluebird, you know? So I wonder
if TV isn't part of the problem, in that it's so easy for me, you know, for my kids to sit and watch a David Attenborough series and see stuff that, frankly, they could spend thousands of hours in the wilderness and never actually see.
Right.
When we did that trip to Texas back in 2007, one of the things Brian commented on and at the time, and I agreed with him, was the one thing I'd really like to see is an armadillo.
Yeah.
But go all the way to Texas, you don't bloody see one.
And I got to tell you, I don't think...
Look on the side of the road.
I still haven't seen a living armadillo, as I said. Yeah. I think they're born dead by the side of the road because I've never seen one.
Paul, what I would say in that example is, you know, it is very easy to plunk your kids in front of the TV and give them this experience that they're probably never going to have in real life. I would say, you know, as a parent, what are you doing then to translate that experience that they've now gotten in an electronic medium to their real life? And that's where I say, like, we as adults have to, sometimes we need to make those decisions, and sometimes we have to practice what we preach and turn off our own electronics and make it a point, make it a priority in the lives of young people, because they're not going to do it themselves. And if they grow up without having it from the parents or adults in their life, then they're not going to have that value when they grow up, and we're going to get continually less connected to nature, at least in sort of the Western world. And I think, you know, bringing it back to the subject of Bigfoot, if you want people to be out there and study this thing and prove that it exists, the further we get as a population away from nature, the less likely that is to happen, I think.
There, to talk to your point about, you know, people getting separated from nature, there was a lady a few years ago who bought my first Pacific Crest Trail documentary I did, and it's called Walk. And I mailed it to her. She watched it, and she goes, "Oh, I really enjoyed it, but it wasn't what I was looking for. I thought I was just going to watch it in front, and I would be on my treadmill, and the camera would be walking, and it would be as though I was in the woods." She literally thought, she didn't bother to read what the film was about. So, wow.
Well, if you had a Steadicam, that would be kind of a cool thing to do. You could just
easy money,
no editing.
Right.
You know?
And, you know, I'm not going to.
It's just a combination of that stuff. Like David was saying, I mean, there's some incredibly rare things that you're going to get great videographers out that they're going to capture. That's great to watch. But, to get to the point where you're reliant on that for your quote unquote nature fix, that's deadly. Because not only that, but there was some scary study result that came out a few months ago. I think it's 20 years from now, the obesity rate in this country is projected to be close to 50% of adults.
Yeah.
That is, man, that's ridiculous. It's like, well, those characters Wall-E.
Yeah, Wall-E.
That's one of the reasons that at National Wildlife Federation, we talk a lot about the health impact of all of that indoor time. And that's just, again, the harsh truth that parents care more about the health of their kids, generally speaking, than they do about how connected their kids are to nature. And so if we want to be smart and we want to be effective as conservationists, you know, we could focus on just our own issues that we care so much about, or we could be savvy and figure out ways of connecting with people on issues that they care about and making the bridge to our issue and connecting the dots for them. So, you have to have strategies like that if you think you're going to be successful, again, at the conservation thing. But, you know, going back to getting kids outdoors, I think a great analogy that I think will helps people kind of wrap their minds around it, the way that I look at it is learning about nature is almost like learning a new language. And so every time I add a new frog call to my knowledge base in my brain, and every time I, learn a new animal track or what a certain species scat looks like, or, you know, what its nest looks like, and I go out and I see those things, it's like adding a new word or a new phrase to this language. And when you do that, I mean, it's the difference between getting plunked down in a country where you don't speak a language and, you know, you sort of have blinders on and you can't really experience it or live in that environment or really appreciate it, and then starting to learn that language and what a vastly different experience that is. I think it's the same thing with nature. And again, you don't have to go out into the wilderness to have this. You can start building that repertoire, that language of understanding nature literally right in your own backyard. That's what my Animal Planet series was about. It was about this idea that nature is all around us, and you can restore elements of the functioning ecosystem in a city or a town by what you plant in your yard. It really was sort of a gardening program. You know, if you plant the right species, you'll recreate some of the habitat that used to be there for birds and butterflies and, you know, obviously animals appropriate to show up in someone's yard. Well, and what better place to start getting your family connected to nature than literally right outside your door?
To that end, in your opinion, what would be the best thing for me to plant to draw a Bigfoot into my yard?
I don't know what they I would say that the best thing to do would be to plant something that they eat, but I don't know what they eat until we get a body and dissect its stomach.
Well, I've heard is they eat pancakes.
That's right, and blueberry muffins or something like that, right?
Yeah, muffins. And what was spice did she give Fox at the back door? What was that? Was it like garlic. Cinnamon or garlic? Right. So garlic plants. So we'll plant garlic anyway.
Brian, you're not getting this right. Obviously, looking at the Matilda photos, what you need is a giant Chewbacca costume with a garlic string around its neck, as if it's one of these stereotypical Frenchmen, and it'd be great. Box of pancakes.
Stereotypical.
You'll have Bigfoot in no time.
Actually, one of our listeners, I've closed the tab on my computer, wanted to know what is the scientific estimate of how many Wookiees are left in the wild at this point? Is there a number?
You know, I am a Star Wars nerd, and even I don't know the answer to that question. So,
this has been a fantastic show, and I'm looking at the questions. We've touched on almost everything people wanted to talk about. We're at 1¾ hours as of right now, essentially. So, I want to thank you, David. You've been a fantastic guest.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, man.
Of course, thanks for having me.
So our next, just so everyone knows, oh, I would be remiss if I didn't go back and talk about the TBRC conference again. The Texas Bigfoot Conference is coming up. There's, for everyone who hasn't been following on Facebook, there's a social the day before, actually at the hotel, the host hotel, which is the Fort Worth Sheraton, where you'll be able to eat some great food and hang out with all the speakers and all the investigators. It's only $50, and you get, like, awesome food, barbecue, brisket, and there's a mashed potato bar. I don't even know what a mashed potato bar is, but there's going to be one there. So you might, and you cannot buy that ticket. You have to buy that ticket in advance. You can't buy it at the door. So if you want to hang out and you can hear my voice and you're in Texas, check that out. Also check out the conference. Tickets are still available. This will be the last show of March. It's only the 3rd, I know, but the rest of March is completely shot for me. So this is it. We won't come back until April. Scott, when is your big debut of the movie?
You sound thrilled. And I got to thank you, because you're one of the producers of the film. As much as we scrap on this show, I love you, man. And I appreciate you being one of the major Kickstarter contributors to Flip Flop Flippin' 2, which is due out March 12th.
The 12th.
At SquatchFilms.com. And it might be a couple extra days on the DVDs, but the MP4 downloads will be available then, and it looks like the Blu-rays will be available. So thank you for that. And I'm happy with it. I'm doing the final rendering and awesome. DVD authoring today. So
as we speak, that's why you
that is true. Funny. Right as the show began, it was like had 5 minutes left. If there's a hum at the beginning of the show, that's what it was. It was my external hard drive.
Paul, what do you want to hype? Anything? You want to plug anything?
Nah.
So David, if people want to follow you.
Nah.
Where do you blog? Where can people see more of you or read more of you?
Yeah, I was going to say, do I get a chance to shamelessly
plug? Sure, plug away.
If folks, you know, again, I work for National Wildlife Federation, so you can just Google National Wildlife Federation. We have tons of ways that people can get involved in conservation, getting kids connected to nature, saving species, and all that good stuff. If you want to go learn a little bit more about me and see some of my TV appearances, my part of our website is nwf.org/naturegeek, and you can see clips of some of my TV appearances, like my most recent Conan O'Brien show appearance. And I'm going to be on the Today Show on the 21st of March, which is a Thursday. Cool. I'll be on in the 10 a.m. hour with Kathy Lee and Hoda, which is I do that monthly. So if folks want to see an appearance live, you can check that out too.
Where do you get the animals?
Hey, David, how did Conan handle your last name?
You know what? The only one that has really, really ever butchered it has been Larry King. The National Wildlife Federation did a lot of work. We actually do a lot of work down in the Gulf of Mexico to protect the Gulf ecosystem. And when the BP oil spill disaster happened and CNN did their telethon, we were one of the three groups that were the recipients of the money that was raised, which was awesome. And so I got to go down there. And, yeah, Larry King, he was like...
That's what I said.
That was pretty much... But everyone else is really good about practicing it beforehand, and they can all pronounce it.
Except,
so
right.
I'm grateful for that. It's not the most mediagenic name, but it's what I got. So,
so you're saying that Larry King and I are essentially equal when it comes to broadcasting.
I give you a leg up, at least when it comes to pronouncing my name.
Right. Where do the animals come from you put on these shows? Where do you get them?
So, yeah, I work with a variety of different facilities that are all sort of legit, licensed facilities that have ambassador animals. These are the animals that we work with that we do education programs with, and sometimes school programs or TV appearances. I use the same folks that people like Jack Hanna uses.
Sure.
So these are not sort of shady characters. I mean, these folks have their permits, they have their USDA oversight, and they take good care of their animals, and they have a conservation mission and things like that, because obviously that's important. We want to make sure that when I do an appearance with wildlife, that we give the right messages that, you know, these aren't pets. These are animals that
right.
have special care and special facilities. They get veterinary care. They have trained wildlife handlers. You know, I just was on the NBC affiliate in New York with a lion cub. One of my regular handlers, you know, recently got and we're working them in shows and stuff. And, you know, when you work with a big cat, I mean, this is a lion cub and I say again, cub in quotes because it was about as big as a German Shepherd.
Jeez.
And quite capable of giving you a pretty bad wound if it decided to bite onto you or scratch you. And so, but it's on a leash and we had it eating, drinking from a bottle and it looks really cute. And, you know, it is easy for the viewer to see that and say, oh, I want one. And so we
right.
always try to make sure.
Right.
To get that message in there that these are animals that we're showing you because nothing beats seeing the real thing in terms of getting people inspired. I could talk until I was blue in the face on camera about a lion, but you put a real lion in there and people pay attention. And so
right.
The point is that lions have declined in Africa by 50% in just the last 30 years. And that's the message that we need to get out there. And, you know, lions need our help. So that's kind of the frame of mind that we go to do these TV shows with and why we work with the folks that we do.
I think the Conan spots are especially great. I mean, some of the best memories I have from my younger days from when I was a kid is when like Joan Embry would come on to the Johnny
yep.
Carson show. Right. I mean, that
yeah.
was just great. I mean, that stuff sticks with you for a really long time. And so
I
just think that's, it's awesome to see that. And I think Conan seems to be a great sport with it. I mean, he does at least as good of a job as Johnny did.
Yeah, Conan's great. I really love being on a show. I've been on three times. I actually had my first appearance just a year ago, last March. And so if folks want to see something really funny, Google Conan Bruise, and you will see a funny behind-the-scenes outtake of something that did not make it into one of my shows where I accidentally might have almost killed him. So I won't say
well,
any more than that.
It wasn't you. I mean, it wasn't like you ran him
was
over.
Bruise? Conan Bruise?
Bruise, yeah. I've seen it.
I won't give it away, but I'll put it this way. We had a very large domesticated species to represent sort of its wild kin. And I suggested that as people do where this animal is native to and where it is a common domesticated species that Conan ride into the studio on its back. And the animal decided that was not a good idea. So I'll let folks go watch the clip.
It's awesome. I've seen it. All right. Well, I think that's it, man. We're coming up on getting close to 2 hours. So again, thank you so much. Awesome show. Great to have you on.
You're welcome.
Awesome. Okay. Well, that's it. We're done.